Chapter 5. Showtime. I hoped that a miracle would happen, and all the factions involved with planning the inauguration would come together in patriotic spirit. If we didn't, the big weekend would be a disaster, an embarrassment to the Trumps, and a humiliation seen around the world. I would not let that happen. Melania, for one, did not deserve that. Our nation, however divided, needed at least to feel proud of the celebration of a new leader. I dug deep and kept going, one frustrating day at a time. 19 days until the swearing-in. As for the gifts for guests at the inaugural events, Lindsay Reynolds and Ramsey Ratcliffe had been in charge. I'd expected that they'd follow protocol from previous administrations, and then thousands of dollars of goods showed up at my door in New York, all from the White House Historical Association. Books, mugs, fleece blankets, scarves, coasters, and tote bags. I'd never seen or approved any of this stuff. And why was it in New York? The events were in D.C. The PIC wanted my approval, which I never gave. I couldn't find room in my apartment for the samples and sent them back to Lindsay at the PIC offices in D.C. 100 emails later, I learned that Heather Martin had approved the gifts for PIC staffers, family and friends, donors, and elected officials. Lindsay and Ramsey blew the entire gift budget of $500,000 on tourist junk to give to family and friends. At one point, Heather asked Ramsey, "Is Stephanie going to source additional gifts?" Ramsey replied, "I do not believe so." She could have asked. Melania Trump was not about to give travel mugs to million-dollar donors at the candlelight dinner. Heather told us Michelle Obama gave crystal bowls from Tiffany & Company at hers. "We have to return it all," I wrote to the brain trust at the PIC 1 in the morning. Heather Martin's bright idea? For 99 cents apiece, we can make sparkling wine bottle favors and put the PIC logo on them. The next morning, I called Melania and said, "Guess what? There's no budget for you and Donald to buy a gift for your guests." "Are you serious?" "Dead serious." Melania would not hear of it. We priced those same Tiffany bowls and made the decision to give one to every couple. We had to beg for extra money for Melania and Donald's gifts. In the end, we still came up short. Some couples took two. Other couples went home empty-handed. 18 days until the swearing-in. Hargrove was in, then out, then in. We didn't know what was happening. Regarding the chairman's global dinner, Rick told us, "My discussion with Hargrove last night was to indicate that they would be involved in certain aspects based on our previous conversations, but that PRG was running point based on the call with PRG from Friday. Unless something has changed between PRG and Hargrove that I am not aware of, nothing has changed. I will reach out to Jim at PRG right now and confirm." 17 days until the swearing-in. Ralph Lauren's team reached out to make sure the first son was taken care of, too. Barron already had his suit, however. Ralph had discussed every tiny detail of Melania's dress design with his team. Was it floor length or knee length? Pencil-shaped? Was the jacket belted? Should it be cropped? Go over the hips? How much volume around the neck? Should the hat be the same fabric? Veiled? They constructed the outfit to Melania's specs and proceeded with fittings. Ralph created a couture ensemble of multiple pieces, a dress, a jacket, a hat, gloves, and a clutch, for Melania to wear to multiple daytime events on January 20th, including the St. John's Episcopal Church prayer service, a White House tea with the Obamas, Bidens, and Pences, the swearing-in ceremony, the Joint Congressional Committee on Inaugural Ceremonies luncheon, and the inaugural parade on Pennsylvania Avenue. 16 days until the swearing-in. Hargrove was not a dependable vendor, to say the least. I spent the last 4 days banging my head against a wall dealing with them, their ridiculously high budgets, and ulcer-inducing execution strategy. Regarding the floor plan for the candlelight dinner, our Emmy-winning production designer wrote to Carla Hargrove McGill, "There's too much wrong with this plan for me to go into without literally sitting next to someone at a computer and school them on some design basics. I'm actually shaking my head at how badly arranged this is." Everything they touched or sourced had to be redone at huge expense. But Rick Gates was elated. The PIC raised too much money, he said. I wasn't sure what that meant, and I didn't have time to find out. I thanked God that David Mann was back in town. We had a great meeting the afternoon before about the two events I needed help with, the candlelight dinner and the chairman's global dinner. The candlelight was high-end. Melania wanted to capture a Camelot moment at the beginning of the Trump presidency. Barrack's dinner was, as Tom said, like the weaving of a tapestry of ambassadors and VIPs from around the world. It would be a very extravagant affair, and attention to detail was paramount. I told David about the ballerina escorts and asked, if this doesn't go away, maybe we should hire male models too. Tom was quite anxious to see some samples of David's vision. David volunteered to load up a U-Haul truck with 120 upholstered tables, chairs, candelabras, place settings, and more from his warehouse. He said he was thinking the driver could leave New York around 5 a.m. to drive it all down to D.C. instead of battling with Hargrove and other vendors for the assets, and I accepted the offer. It shouldn't have been necessary. You'd think we could rent everything we needed in Washington. I didn't know if Pick was reallocating part of Hargrove's budget to David, although we believed they'd already been paid some, and the budget Heather sent was like smoke and mirrors math, with placeholder numbers where the real ones should be. We were 2 weeks out. Perhaps you've planned a wedding. Venue, food, alcohol, tables, place cards, invites, custom floral arrangements, entertainment, an AV system, parking, gifts, for a couple hundred people. How long does that usually take? 6 months? We had to organize all the basics, along with security, road clearance, a motorcade entrance, building a stage and media platform, signage, custom carpeting, and a VIP pre-party in a fucking train station for 1,500 VIP donors in 15 days while we were also planning 17 other events. And I thought the Met Gala was stressful? Compared to the inauguration, that was like planning a kid's birthday party. I got really upset that afternoon about how crazy all this was. The pressure, the increasing pain in my neck. I was on the verge of saying, fuck it, and walking out. David Mon calmed me down. He said, breathe. Inhale lavender, exhale pink, and the world will be prettier. And you know, it really was. 15 days until the swearing-in. Hervé Pierre, a French-born, naturalized American designer with stellar credentials, had been recommended to Melania and met with her at Trump Tower. Coincidentally, I arrived just as he was leaving. Seeing each other, we squealed, hugged, and did the classic, oh my God, how are you? I was so happy to see a familiar face. Hervé and I had worked together for 11 years. As soon as he left, I told Melania that she had to bring him in. He's an incredible talent. Snap him up. She did, as her personal stylist. Melania and I had been talking about who would be designing the gown she would wear to the inaugural balls, the Liberty Ball, the Freedom Ball, and the Salute to Our Armed Services Ball, and for Donald and Melania's first dance as the first couple to My Way. This was a major decision. It was going to be a part of a two-hour live broadcast, and her look had to be perfect. It was a historically important look, too. Melania's choice would be displayed in the Smithsonian National Museum of American History's The First Lady's Exhibit. Melania's counterparts have been donating their inaugural gowns since Lady Bird Johnson. Everyone presumed it would be Karl Lagerfeld. I had a better idea. It would be incredible if you and Hervé Pierre designed a gown together, I suggested. He has the qualifications, and the story would be great. I wanted to highlight the magnitude of two immigrants making something together, but I didn't bring it up because she would have probably decided against it. Melania loved the idea of getting to play designer for a day, but highlighting to the press that she and Hervé were both immigrants was out of the question. Her take was to let the clothing speak for itself and not to bother with the backstory. I was just thrilled that Hervé would get his moment to shine. For her collaboration with Hervé, Melania gathered inspirational looks of tailored dresses with sharp lines. He described them as no-fuss style. Once they had a clear aesthetic, he began sketching. Although Hervé and Melania spoke a common language of design, they spoke to each other in English. Not once did I hear or see either of them speak or write in French. It seemed odd to me. Melania claims to be fluent in Hervé's native language. Come to think of it, I have never heard her speak a single word of any language besides English and Slovenian with her parents and Baron. Not that I'm saying that there's anything wrong with speaking only two languages. That's one more than I can. But I've never claimed otherwise. Hervé texted me. I'm putting the dress to work on Monday. I'm so honored. She's really fabulous. I love her. I can't hide it. We started to speak about money, but I told her that the priority of the moment was her gown and we shall speak about feet after the inauguration. His first mistake. Never try to get money from a Trump after the fact. Hervé updated me at every step of the process, as he had muslin fittings, sewed on the embellishments, and made petite sketchbooks of her outfits. But he still hadn't pushed Melania about payment. I asked him why, and he admitted, "I'm afraid." I knew exactly how he felt. There's an imperiousness, a grandeur, about the Trumps that makes one scared to mention something as trifling as fair compensation. People tend to tiptoe around the subject. The Trumps treat people as if being in their orbit is its own reward. 14 days until the swearing-in. Soon after the election, Anna Wintour had visited Trump Tower to congratulate Donald and invited him to meet with the editors of each Condé Nast magazine at their One World Trade Center offices in the coming days. Per Melania, I heard that Ivanka was playing matchmaker between Anna and Donald behind the scenes. Melania said Donald told her to come down from the penthouse and join the meeting in his office. It sounded more like an afterthought. She didn't go. I could hear in her voice that her feelings were hurt. She thought of Anna as a kind of friend. As he and Anna had discussed, Donald took an off-the-record trip on January 6th to meet with the Condé Nast editors, some of whom had raked him over the coals for decades, like Graydon Carter of Vanity Fair, who dubbed Donald the short-fingered Bulgarian at his previous gig as the founding editor of Spy magazine. David Remnick of The New Yorker was no Trump fan either, and yet they all sat at a conference room table together and talked about Vladimir Putin, women's rights, and climate change. Tom Barrack went with Donald to the hour-long morning meeting. Although Tom and I had had some tense exchanges, we got along well. I spoke my mind, which he seemed to like. I wondered if anyone else talked to him the way I did. Since Condé Nast was my haunt, as he said, it was cool that he kept me updated on the meeting by text. He sent me a photo of Anna smiling charmingly and described her as the meeting's host. Another photo showed the entire table and all the editors. "Graydon looks like he saw a ghost," Tom texted. Of Anna, he wrote, "Elegant ice queen." 13 days until the swearing-in. On January 7th, I was in New York, and John was in D.C. when he texted, "Trouble. Hargrove had sent him samples of the lockup, a.k.a. the presidential seal. The inauguration of Donald J. Trump, the 45th president of the United States of America, that was printed on all graphics, scenic backdrops, and stage sets for the Trump inauguration. Please note that Tom himself has approved option 4 of the attached, but waiting on you, SWW, for approval on rest, ASAP," he said. Trump is a branding machine, and maintaining a visually consistent Trump on all his collateral was paramount. This included every color palette, inaugural seal adaptation, and font, along with the presidential seal. Much to our disbelief, the designs included both Donald J. Trump's and Mike Pence's names. Historically, it should have only the president's name. "Tom and Rick approved the Trump-Pence lockup," John said after he had researched it, and told me no previous inaugural lockups had both names. I was picturing Melania and Donald's first dance with POTUS and VP splashed across the screen. Why give Pence's name such prominence and defy tradition? Was this a positioning of Pence as Trump's equal in standing in the administration? I heard rumors from all kinds of sources about Mike Pence being owned, lock, stock, and Bible, by billionaire corporate overlords who intended to elevate him to president as soon as possible. I marched right over to Trump Tower and showed the lockup to Melania and Donald. John, who was with Rick and Tom the same time I was with the Trumps, later told me that Tom took a call from Donald, hung up, and said, "That fucking bitch." The new lockup design hit my inbox within the hour with Mike Pence's name removed. Later that night, after I got home, I had second thoughts about what I'd done. I'd really pissed off Tom, and I really didn't want to be on his bad side. But I was just watching out for Melania and Donald. I called Melania in such a panic that she put Donald on the call. "Am I going to end up on the bottom of the Potomac River?" I asked them. "Don't worry, Stephanie," said Donald. "You're fine." 12 days until the swearing-in. We were less than 2 weeks out. Rick said, "We need to finalize all budgets today to the extent possible and lock down the numbers. In addition, we need to review the budget line items for each event, particularly the Hargrove pieces." He directed Heather to take the lead and circulate the latest budgets for each of the events to everyone. We need to see as much budget detail as possible. I will find a time today that we can all meet to review the events and corresponding budgets. As we schedule the meeting, if you need to bring in others to support this exercise, then please let us know. The PIC still didn't have a budget? How is that possible? Some things were solidifying. We had a talent roster for the concert on the Mall. Toby Keith, John Voight, the Piano Guys, Lee Greenwood, DJ Ravi Drums, and Three Doors Down, among others. Clearly, we needed more performers. The broadcast on the Lincoln Memorial was shaping up, but we still had a two-hour live broadcast at the Convention Center for approximately 40,000 people, though that number was highly contested. Executive producer Carol Donovan came up with the genius idea to ping-pong the broadcast from stage A, B, and C in the Convention Center to DE, keeping the performance pace moving for live broadcast. We had the Rockettes confirmed, but we needed more talent. I called my friend and Goodwill Ambassador of Peace, Lord of the Dance Michael Flatley, and asked him if he would consider hopping on a plane with his troopers and performing at the inaugural. Without missing a beat, they took D.C. by storm. He was a savior. God bless him. Then Donald went on a rampage about seeing a tablecloth for the candlelight dinner, and I had to run to the PIC office to get it to Tom so he could show it to him. Every detail and decision required dozens of emails, texts, and calls, and Donald Melania's input and approval. That night, John reached out to Wiz partners Mel Johnson, Owen Lineback, Kyle Young, and me, saying, "Meet in my room, ASAP." Our anxiety and stress skyrocketed. We were all a little paranoid. We emptied the minibar, swearing our rooms were being tapped and we were being followed, by whom we could only surmise. John didn't mince words. "What the fuck is going on here?" Real or imagined, we had our suspicions. Around 2 a.m., Mel walked me to my room. I hugged her goodnight, feeling my heart thumping and my mind racing. Since early January, Ivanka had been agitating about the family portrait, a traditional photo of the new first family, usually shot in the blue room of the White House. She'd been sending me emails she'd received from famous photographers Max Vadukul and Mark Seliger asking to shoot it. Melania turned them all down. Ivanka could have risen Richard Avedon from the dead for that family portrait, and Melania would have said, "Nope." The only photographer Melania would work with was Régine Mahou, who flew in from Paris for the big day with a team of five to capture Melania's every second. The scheduling of the portrait was up for debate. Rick Gates sent Ivanka some options, and she went back to him asking for specific times, along with when sunset would occur, so the timing didn't interfere with Shabbat. Melania was not thrilled about Ivanka steering the schedule and would not allow it. Neither was she happy to hear that Ivanka insisted on walking in the Pennsylvania Avenue parade with her children. After I'd met with the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Agency, District of Columbia, Melania and I discussed pending security issues. She was cautious, and rightfully so. She did not want to put Barron in harm's way and told me, "We're not walking at all." We'd heard rumors about snipers and death threats. I was so scared about the rumors, I called off the Girl Scouts from walking the parade route, too. Melania, however, decided to take a few steps, at least. 11 days until the swearing-in. Tom traveled the globe making sure the most powerful people in the world would be at the chairman's global dinner to formalize inroads with the new administration. The dinner wasn't one of the three events Wiz Media Partners had signed on for, so my partners desperately wanted out, but I just couldn't leave him in the lurch. Tom emailed me, "No one is returning our calls, and we need to finalize design and numbers today on chairman dinner and candlelight. If your event team is withdrawing, it is okay, and we will wrap it up appropriately. Of course, this process is frustrating for all. We just need to drive forward one way or the other tonight." I couldn't walk away from Tom for such a historic assembling during the inauguration, and I told him so. "Thanks," he said. "And at this point, we can bask in simplicity that we could just execute perfectly. If only." There was no shortage of drama brewing on other fronts. Rona Graff forwarded me an invoice from Monique Bro, the woman whom we'd fired from redecorating the Oval Office. The total amount, $22,000. Monique kindly waived $12,000 in design time, so her bill ended up being only $10,000. Rona asked me if the bill would be covered by the PIC, even though the Oval Office redesign had nothing to do with the inauguration, I said, no, and she took care of it. It seemed like every person was trying to run off with money from the pick. I tried to block all inaugural events from being held at the Trump Hotel, but Ivanka, Don Jr., and Eric had figured out a way to do it after all. Rick sent Ivanka an email that I was mistakenly CC'd on. There will be an after party at the Trump International Hotel following the inaugural balls on Friday. DJT is not expected to attend, but it was more for you, Don, and Eric. Rick had previously told me that he had spoken with Ivanka and they had decided not to have the after party, but this email was proof the party was on after all. Ivanka wouldn't lose a second's sleep about using PIC donations to pay for a party for herself and her brothers at her family's property to honor her father, who wasn't even going to be there. The Trump Hotel was also booked for the leadership luncheon, with each kid hosting a table. This family was not pulling any punches. 10 days until the swearing-in. David had magnificent tables that he'd brought from his storage in New York that were upholstered with studs, but we told Tom, David and I want DJT to be happy, and he wants tablecloths, so cloths he will have. 8 days until the swearing-in. Ivanka texted me a photo of Barack Obama swearing-in, his hand on the Bible, Michelle, Malia, and Sasha standing to his left. She wrote, FYI regarding the swearing-in, it is nice to have family with him for this special moment. Why send this to me? She wanted to make sure I knew how badly she wanted to be in the iconic photo, the one people would remember of her father's hand on the Bibles, taking the oath of office. I can understand that she wanted to be by her father's side for this historic moment, of course. But why was she coming to me for this? Did she think I would persuade Melania to step aside? That wasn't happening. 5 days until the swearing-in. Melania and I launched Operation Block Ivanka to keep her face out of that iconic special moment. To plan this, I needed to know exactly where the family would be seated and the camera angles. Tiny Horse executive Brandon Moralfo, who managed all the budget with Mel Johnson, sent me notes from the walkthrough. He had been prohibited from taking pictures. Instead, he'd drawn a sketch to give me a decent overview of the Trump section and where the chairs would be positioned in a semicircle around the dais. We knew where the cameras would be located because the platforms were already in place. Using Brandon's sketch, we were able to figure out whose face would be visible when Donald and Melania sat in their seats, and then when the family stood with Chief Justice John Roberts for Donald to take the oath of office. If Ivanka was not on the aisle, her face would be hidden while she was seated. For the standing part, we put Barron between Donald and Melania and made sure that Don Jr. stood next to Melania, not Ivanka. We were all exhausted and stressed out. Yes, Operation Block Ivanka was petty. Melania was in on this mission. But in our minds, Ivanka shouldn't have made herself the center of attention in her father's inauguration. This sentiment was confirmed when Ivanka wrote to Rick yet again about the family portrait. It would be really helpful to me if we could do the earlier time, she said. Do you think that you can make that happen? Looping in Stephanie. Loop me out, please. Melania said, no, we cannot make it happen. In all fairness, whose scheduling needs were more important? The president-elect and the soon-to-be first ladies, or Ivanka's? She should have been accommodating them. Later that day, I received an email from her office. I noticed that Ivanka's car is not part of the family motorcade. Is there any way to add that? It never ended. Rachel reached out. I still have not received any invitations for the inauguration. Shall I book cars? Melania's guest list included a couple dozen people. We weren't surprised by the lack of respect for Melania. Arm's distance, Rachel said. Don't trust anyone but your family. And just protect our girl, MK. 4 days until the swearing-in. The network still hadn't gotten the transmission and satellite coordinates from the PIC. Without the proper codes, there would be no broadcast. John reached out to the PIC's communications department. As you know, the objective is to get as many eyeballs on the welcome celebration and inaugural balls, right? Would PIC like to provide the transmission and satellite info to anyone who'd want access to it? We couldn't understand why the pic would sabotage the viewership of Trump's inauguration. I pushed John to call them out on their bullshit. He said, I need them to send the information. Only they have the press database. Could you imagine if the viewership of the inauguration was zero? Donald would have likely said, off with their heads. 3 days until the swearing-in. January 17th, 2017, curtain call. It was go time. It was the first night of the official 58th Presidential Inauguration Committee events, opening with Tom Barrack's Chairman's Global Dinner beginning at 6:30 p.m. at the Andrew W. Mellon Auditorium. POTUS flew into town without Melania. Tom was pleased, and it made all of the inroads worth battling. We had our morning walkthrough at the convention center, two balls coming right up. The site supervisor raised some concerns and expressed his frustration to me. And much to his relief, I wasn't in disbelief. It was alarming but not surprising. I looped Rick in to let him know that most of the constituents hadn't received their tickets to the balls, and there was confusion regarding digital ticketing versus hard copy. Rick had the answer at his fingertips. Tickets are being distributed at several locations depending on which group you are part of. For example, tickets are being distributed at Trump Hotel and the Fairmont. Additionally, other tickets have been sent via email, and we have several thousands of people that have received them. As a backup, we have paper tickets, should the need arise to use them. I had no idea what he was talking about. Guests would have to go pick up their tickets? The press release for the two inaugural balls went out and announced that there were $50 tickets for the general public to purchase at the PIC website. Too bad the website didn't work. That same day, Melania forwarded me an email from Lynn Patton, Eric Trump's personal assistant, who is now head of Region 2 in the Department of Housing and Urban Development, addressed to the main office at the Trump Organization. It said that the physical tickets were to be trashed. If you have already received email or physical tickets to any events, please disregard. They are no longer valid, wrote Patton. Reprinted valid tickets would have to be picked up at certain hotels in the area, Trump's and Barrack's. I had a walkthrough at a few venues that day, and the event managers were afraid no one was going to show up. No one would explain the ticket snafu to us. We wondered, had the tickets ever gotten printed? That was a question for Ted Jarrett of Cavalier Communications, who, as I found out later, per the PIC IRS Form 990, was paid $3,999,585 to design and print all the tickets and invitations. We never saw them. The incompetence and mishandling of information never stopped, and neither did the fake outrage. Rona forwarded an email from Hope Hicks, written by a woman named Stephanie Grisham from PIC's communications team, who was known to be an Ivanka favorite. SWW Production Company has been tasked with a made-for-TV broadcast of some kind and are refusing to allow any still photographers in the head-on shot at one of the memorials for Inauguration Day, wrote Grisham. This was a spot that was prearranged and approved by PIC, allowing members of the major outlets, AP, Getty, AFP, Reuters, New York Times, etc., to be there. And now that access has been rescinded. Suffice it to say, the outlets are all very upset. I bring this up because I fear this could become a story or that the major outlets could boycott things altogether. Notice how she just said SWW Productions? We were Wiz Media Partners. She only used my initials because this wasn't about access for photographers. It was about making trouble for me. I copied John and Ronan on a reply. We are doing everything collaboratively with PIC, so I'm not sure what she is talking about. John sent out an email to explain what was really going on. Stephanie Grisham and Hope Hicks are working with Boris Epstein's PIC comms team. All press positioning, accreditation, and access is handled by that team, not us. For the three broadcast stages we are producing, we have worked with PIC comms team to ensure press risers are in place for both TV and still photography. We presented to Mr. Trump last week. Our setup ensures maximum viewership for the two-hour show to beat Obama's audience. Let me know if Hope or you have any remaining questions. Beating Obama's numbers was the directive from above. Rona said, thank you, Stephanie and John, for clarifying this. One less thing to worry about now. I had to do an on-camera press interview for the convention center, the location of the two inaugural balls, and I was a nervous wreck, completely exhausted. John handed me a bottle of tequila and said, "Drink this." If I hadn't had a swig, I wouldn't have made it through that interview. 2 days until the swearing in. January 18th, 2017. We were on a roll. Ivanka emailed, "Will there be a step and repeat at the candlelight dinner? Where will it be?" I assured her there would indeed be photographers from Getty Images and Women's Wear Daily, and that the step and repeat was in the reception area. She could pose alone, with Jared, with friends, and make pouty faces until rictus set in. As an aside, she wrote, "I was chatting with Dad about how amazing he thought the event was yesterday, the chairman's global dinner. He was blown away by how beautifully everything was done. I mentioned that initially there was going to be limited press, and he told me to make sure you had tons of press at the candlelight dinner and balls. He thinks that they will be beautiful and wants it well documented. Major red carpet." Ivanka and Grisham were on the same page. Need more press. I replied, "We have provided every opportunity to make all the inaugural events as open to press as possible." Why did I feel like I had to justify myself to her? By this point, she had to realize that the PIC tried to keep every event closed to the press, which made no sense to John and me. I was caught in the middle. Ralph Lauren's team emailed to confirm that Melania was going to wear all 5 items at all the planned events. She replied to me that she wasn't going to wear the bag or the hat. "Won't wear it. Don't tell RL team." After all the work that went into that hat, I was sad it wouldn't see the light of day. I wish I'd known earlier to give them a heads up, but at least her elegant updo made up for the tragic loss. Melania lands in D.C. 1 day until the swearing in. Finally, the day I was most excited for, Thursday, January 19th, 2017. Melania's unveiling to the world, her first appearance at the inauguration of her husband, the 45th President of the United States. David texted me that he and the kids had arrived in Washington. I was so excited to see them, but so overwhelmed and stressed out. The streets were packed with protesters, and David and the kids got blocked by barricades and couldn't make their way to the hotel. My hands were tied. I called Rick, who thankfully took care of it. I spent much of the day backstage at the dress rehearsal for the Lincoln Memorial Concert, meeting with the crew, reviewing and revising the run of show based on Melania and Donald's timing, and making sure Women's Wear Daily was ready to go with its embargoed exclusives on Melania's fashion. The clock was ticking when Melania texted me, on way to Arlington. Her first appearance during inauguration weekend was a visit to Arlington National Cemetery, where more than 400,000 American veterans are buried, for the ceremonial traditional laying of a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier by the President-elect and Vice-President-elect to pay tribute to the U.S. Armed Forces and the veterans who made the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom. Melania did not want the kids at Arlington. I tried my best, but after I sent Ivanka a schedule that left Arlington off, she texted, "Has the wreath-laying ceremony been canceled? I am pretty confused, as I had always planned to attend and was going to bring her daughter, Arabella, as well. Can you please give me a call to discuss? This is very different from what was confirmed." She didn't miss a trick. I wanted to reply, "Melania doesn't want you there. It was her first appearance of Inauguration Week. She wanted the event to be with her family, Barron and her parents." I almost wrote to Ivanka, "Out of respect for our fallen heroes, this isn't a photo op and should be handled with dignity and humility." But Ivanka got her way. Don Jr. and Eric also came with their spouses. After Arlington, the President-elect and the family made their way over to the Make America Great Again welcome celebration at the Lincoln Memorial, which was broadcast live for all to see. We were going to be live on TV, and we were running late. While they were in the car on their way over, I was standing in the wings with Mark Burnett and John Voight, the MC of the concert, waiting. John Reinaga texted, "Where are they? Once they arrive, get the family seat in the box." The VIP box was the family seating area, a bulletproof glass enclosed cube with chairs at stage right for the Trumps. Tom Barrack joined them. I texted Melania at 3:23 p.m., "What's your ETA?" and sent her a video of me walking in my heels down the 21 steps from the top of the Lincoln Memorial to the VIP box with my arm on PIC staffer Tim Trepepe and added, "Are you okay walking down these stairs? Donald must hold your arm. Do you want to take my job?" Smiling face with smiling eyes emoji, she asked. At 3:51 p.m., she reached out to say, "Just leaving Arlington." 2 minutes later, I told her, they are holding the show for you. And she replied, 3 minutes away. Should we come in or wait? With a palm to my forehead, I said, go into holding green room. Enter the Trumps, 20 minutes later. Melania and Donald appear at the top of the Lincoln Memorial, standing in front of the 19-foot-tall Georgia marble statue of Abraham Lincoln. I will never forget the sight of Donald and Melania standing there, crowds applauding, then walking down those long, steep steps to make their grand entrance, her arm perfectly wrapped around his, just the way I told her. She didn't falter. Following the president-elect's first planned remarks in Washington, D.C., fireworks by Grucci, kindly discounted, lit up the National Mall. It was a triumph, and Melania looked magnificent, indeed, in her black military-inspired jacket and dark sunglasses. The next big event that night was the candlelight dinner in Union Station, the elegant black-tie sit-down dinner Melania and Donald were hosting for 1,500 guests on the eve of the swearing-in ceremony. The inspiration for the event was Camelot. Melania had told me she was a great admirer of Jacqueline Kennedy. On a June 24, 2019 phone interview with Fox and Friends, President Trump likened that former iconic First Lady to his wife, saying, we have our own Jackie O today. It's called Melania. Melania. We'll call it Melania T, okay? Yes, he called his wife it. Kennedy worship might be one of the few things Melania and Ivanka have in common. Ivanka and Jared are big Camelot fans, too. It's no coincidence that all three of their children, Arabella, Joseph, and Theodore, share names with Kennedy family members. Edward Ted Kennedy and Joseph Kennedy, you know. Arabella Kennedy was JFK and Jackie's stillborn daughter. Between the MAGA concert and the formal Camelot-themed candlelight dinner, I'd no time to get to a private room to change. So I went into one of the production tents behind the Lincoln Memorial, asked the staffers to give me a moment, and tugged on my dress in relative privacy. Melania looked glamorous that evening in a glimmering gold floor-length gown that was designed by Reem Acra, a Lebanese-born, New York-based American designer. The Jim Gray Orchestra, whose compositions and arrangements have been featured on NBC's The Sing-Off, America's Got Talent, and Big Brother Australia, did a magnificent job entertaining the guests. They played classics by George Gershwin, Leonard Bernstein, and Aaron Copland, and ended the evening with Mona Lisa, Days of Wine and Roses, and New York, New York. The candlelight dinner itself was a huge success, and I did get some love that night from the Trumps. When Donald gave his speech to the crowd, he said, Stephanie, where's Stephanie? What a job. Are you okay now? That last part referred to all the times I had cried hysterically to him, saying I was afraid I was going to be thrown into the Potomac River. When he said, are you okay now? No one else could possibly have understood what he meant, and I couldn't quite believe he'd say it in a room full of people. But then again, how could I be surprised by anything that came out of his mouth? At the end of the evening, I crossed through the barrier of Secret Service men to get to the Trump's table and squatted between Donald and Melania to say hello. Melania stood up, pulled me into a big hug, and said for only for me to hear, thank you for everything. Her eyes shone and I felt a real zing, a hit of love energy passing between us. In that moment, just for that moment, my 8 weeks in hell felt worth it. The next day, I got a lovely note from Mark Burnett about the concert on the National Mall. Congratulations on such a successful concert. I wanted to reach out to say how impressed I was by the entire production team. I can't imagine the countless hours and dedication that went into making this show, and I hope you know that your hard work truly paid off. No, I replied, thank you. It was his vision, his broadcast team, and his relationships with Donald that made it all possible. The production service agreement between Wiz Media Partners and the Roush Wagner Company, IP, was not signed until that day. The day of. January 20th, 2017, arrived too quickly and not a moment too soon. The 58th presidential inauguration of the 45th president of the United States, Donald J. Trump, was upon us. The Trumps kept to tradition and spent the night at Blair House. Melania assigned rooms. The first family was awake early and waiting for Donald and Melania to start this historic day. Donald signed the Blair House guestbook by 8:15 a.m., and then they made their way to the service at St. John's Episcopal Church. 9:30 a.m., the president-elect and Mrs. Trump arrived at the north portico of the White House and were then hosted inside by the Obamas and Bidens for tea, along with the Pences. She wore the Ralph Lauren ensemble as planned. I couldn't believe I was responsible for what this woman would be wearing in the procession to the Capitol and the swearing-in ceremony at the 58th presidential inauguration of the United States of America. The first peek most Americans got at the much-loved and labored-over ensemble was when the Trumps arrived at the White House to be greeted by President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama. Donald, ever the gentleman, not, rushed up the steps without waiting for Melania or taking her arm. Melania gifted Michelle a blue box from Tiffany & Company that contained a silver picture frame. Meanwhile, the risers at the Capitol began to fill up with former presidents, senators, and members of Congress. Tom, Rick, and the family stacked the rows. Melania's guests were not seated up there. Donald's opponent, Hillary Clinton, stood within rows of Melania's seat. On a day that must have been excruciating for her, Clinton wore a suffragette white cashmere coat and pantsuit by Ralph Lauren. If Melania had known Hillary would also be dressed in Ralph Lauren, she would have been angry and might have decided not to wear the outfit. To me, his designing both women's outfits proved Lauren was truly an American icon. Around 10 a.m., the outgoing president and vice president and their families walked their incoming counterparts to the Capitol. Melania walked gracefully down the steps. She took her seat next to Barron, in front of Tiffany, Ivanka, Jared, Don Jr., Don's then-wife, Vanessa, Eric, and Eric's wife, Laura. The gang was all there. By 11 a.m., my family arrived at the Capitol, and I was informed my tickets were for standing area only. Forget about sitting on the riser. We didn't have a seat anywhere. We'd have to sit on the grass. The explanation from the pick for this oversight came from Cassidy Dumbald, who said, "We didn't think she needed passes because she'd be working." My husband knew the work I'd put in, the months I'd been away from him and the kids to make this happen. Being told to go sit on the grass was more than an insult. It was a massive fuck you very much. Fortunately, as David, the kids, and I were heading toward the spectator area, I ran into a Trump insider named Frank Mermeau. He said, "Where are you going, Stephanie?" "Our tickets are for way back there," I said. "Come over here." He brought us to a VIP area about 300 feet away from the stage that had seats but not much of a view, unfortunately, but still way better than nothing. We watched the swearing-in on the two massive screens from there. It was only good luck that Frank saw us in the crowd and let us in. At 11:30 a.m., the big moment finally arrived. Once we were settled and the ceremony started, I focused on witnessing history with my family. Later, when Melania asked, "How are your seats?" I told her we didn't have seats. Her response was, "We were told the same by many of our guests. If the shoe had been on the other foot, I would have been apoplectic." Rachel Roy was watching on TV from her hotel room in Washington. She texted a photo she'd taken of the screen showing Melania's head completely blocking Ivanka's. "Happy MT blocked IT. Three face with tears of joy emojis." I started laughing so hard, David thought something was wrong with me. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir sang "America the Beautiful," followed by Jackie Evancho, who performed the national anthem. Right after the swearing-in, I walked back to Trump International Hotel with my family and David Mann. We didn't stay around for the parade. We had too much to do for the balls at the convention center. Melania was taking her stroll down Pennsylvania Avenue, and she looked imperial in her baby blue Ralph Lauren suit. John was already at the convention center. "Meet me in the broadcast production trailer," he said. Tom was leaving the hotel in an armed escort car that would get me to the convention center hassle-free. I couldn't say the same for my family, and I felt awful. Protests were taking place on the streets as well as in my head, and I told David, "I don't want the kids and you to be out there trying to get to the convention center. Maybe watch it on TV." They weren't about to do that after all I'd sacrificed to make this happen, and besides, they were excited. I got them a placard for the car window that enabled them to pass through security checkpoints. David told me, "Not to worry, I love you." I kissed them all goodbye and said, "I love you guys." Tom and I hopped in the car. We were sort of speechless. With so much going on, both of our fingers were doing all the talking into our cell phones. I was picturing the Trumps in the White House taking their family portrait. Liberty and Freedom, the official presidential inaugural balls, were open to the public and broadcast live far and wide by the Rausch Wagner Company, a.k.a. IP. Those balls were followed by the Salute to Our Armed Services Ball, open to invited guests who serve our country and our communities at home and abroad. This event was produced by Walter Kinsey of Encore Live. The President of the United States of America and First Lady Melania Trump, late again, danced to My Way at the Liberty Ball, then were joined on stage by the family and the Pence family as well, and then went downstairs to Halls D&E in the Convention Center and did it all over again. For the portrait, Melania debuted her collaboration with Hervé Pierre. The floor-length dress was off the shoulder, with six layers of vanilla silk crepe, matching vanilla silk gazard details, and a red silk veil ribbon to accentuate her waist. Hervé's gown was a smash among the guests at the inaugural balls and the breathless press. In the coming days, Hervé was inundated with media requests from all over the world, and he seemed excited about being part of something this big. But he still didn't have the confidence to ask FLOTUS for feedback or payment. Meanwhile, I received an email with the subject line, OPO Inaugural Celebration Invitation. OPO stood for Old Post Office, the location of the Trump International Hotel. The First Family invites you to attend a very intimate inaugural celebration after the official inaugural balls. This email is intended only for you as an individual and does not include a guest unless otherwise indicated, it said. The after party. It was happening, and the PIC was paying for it. We didn't attend. The day after. Ralph Lauren's team reached out to let me know that Ralph says, "Good work, Lady W. Coverage is great. Hillary and Ralph Lauren, too. I loved them." I forwarded to Melania a news item that reported Ralph Lauren company stock had soared after the inauguration, despite calls on Twitter for a boycott. She replied with a snippy, "They must be happy." That was it. No, "I'm happy for them," or "Thank Ralph so much and Charles and Kimball for all their hard work," or "Thank you for leveraging relationships you'd built over two decades to help me look my best." I wasn't expecting a round of applause, but an acknowledgement of their graciousness would have been nice, even if she was bitter about sharing a designer with Hillary. Although Frank had gone out of his way to give us better seats for the swearing-in, from where I had been in the VIP area, I hadn't been able to see the moment that captivated the nation the day after. Toward the end of the ceremony, with the family and VIPs assembled on the riser, Barron, on Melania's right, started fidgeting. Ivanka and Tiffany were standing behind them. Donald turned around to smile at his wife. She smiled back at him. As soon as he turned away, she frowned aggressively. Twitter went nuts, and the hashtag #FreeMelania was born. Viewers of the footage assumed that she only smiled when Donald was watching, and as soon as his eyes were off her, she let her true contempt show. It wasn't at all what had happened. Melania suddenly frowned and looked down and to her right because Barron had kicked her in the ankle by accident, she explained to me later. It hurt, and her annoyed face reflected that. As her advisor, I suggested she set the record straight about the hashtag #FreeMelania frown. She said, "Who cares what they think? It's my private business. I don't owe them an explanation." They happen to be the American people. In the aftermath, I received an email from Rick. "What an epic experience we shared together. Nothing will ever change that. At least now you will be better prepared in 4 years when we do it again, right?" Nope.